Welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live streaming interview series, where leading New Thought teachers, speakers, and authors share the intimate stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that inspired them the most on their spiritual journey. From well-known classics to hidden gems you might never have heard of, the No BS Spiritual Book Club saves you time and money by sharing reliable recommendations from those who've walked the path before you. The No BS Spiritual Book Club, the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to inspire your own journey of self-discovery. Here's your host, founder of the No BS Spiritual Book Club, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello, welcome. Talent and creativity are as integral to the being of this week's guest as the blood that runs through her veins. Karen Sperling grew up in Hollywood, a scion of one of the most famous families in the film industry. Her mother was a sculptress, painter, and a well-respected political activist. One cousin was a renowned New York City restaurateur and entrepreneur. Another was a highly respected literary agent. And there's more, but we'll get to them later. And Karen's own expertise spans a considerable number of subject areas. An innovator, author, playwright, and pioneering filmmaker who's adapted and written original screenplays for feature films, she was the first woman to write, produce, and direct award-winning feature-length films, and the first filmmaker to hire an all-female crew. Her books include educational novels about the medical profession and a groundbreaking series of unique interactive children's books, and she's written an original musical. And that's not all. Karen designed and coordinated the Story Project for RKO Pictures, a literacy program mentoring storytelling and writing for inner city youth. She's a trained and certified bioenergy medicine practitioner, a member of an interfaith community that serves the homeless and families with AIDS, and a musician in a street jam band. Karen Sperling, welcome.
So busy.
I was going to say, where'd you get the time?
For years. I won't say how old I am.
Years, yeah, yeah. So the books you've chosen as your 10 best are the ones that you say influenced what you believed in and how you put that to use in your life and career. Have we got a little bell going off, something in the oven?
My dear friend is texting me to say that I look good. Thank you.
Well, tell her to stop texting.
I turn off.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about books, what they've meant to you.
Well, my father was taught the Plato Society in his older years, but he was an intellectual and had a huge library. And I used to, and he was a writer, he was also a writer, and I used to pull books from his library like Chart, I think things that were so inappropriate for me as a teenager, but I wanted to identify with him. So I wanted to read things that he was reading, but he was a brilliant man and full of good humor too. So I think I just followed him. And my mom always had stacks of books next to her bed. Read till 97 had stacks of books next to her bed. So I think they were the best example for me.
Yeah. How challenging was it for you to pick just 10?
You know, it wasn't only because I decided to choose the ones that were people that I ended up doing stuff with or, you know, in other words, learning from and then joining. So I kind of did it in terms of where I became activated by what I had read. These are not like the greatest books I've ever read, but these were very much influencing everything that I chose to do along the way. And I discovered something doing this, of course, which your other interviewers have said, about finding out something about yourself when you do this. And I realize every single one I have picked to interact with in reality, as well as read, were rebels. Irreverent people who did things out of the box or disagreed with the norm. And yahoo, what good company was in.
For sure, yeah. I would say that that fits you very nicely.
Yeah.
So let's start with your first book. And I think we're going through these in chronological order because there's stories attached to each one about what you were doing at that time. So the first book, which goes beyond the usual theories of mental illness and alienation and makes a convincing case for the madness of morality. It is, of course, The Politics of Experience by R.D. Lang, published in 1967.
Yeah, he, you know, what he basically said was what we call normal is our disturbed society. So how do we get these disturbed people to become more disturbed the way we are? And I loved that. And I loved him for that. And I also felt that I reread the book several times, but he basically stated that we don't share who we are at all. We are in reality with each other, but what about our fantasies? What about our dreams? And really weaving those together. I talk more about him, but I can tell you how he influenced then what I ended up doing, because I ended up making feature films based on that trajectory of studying a character. And so I had dreams, fantasy, and reality all in one film where you couldn't tell which was which in the days of, that was the days of Antonioni and Blow Up, and, you know, where people were going, what's real, what's not real. And so here I was, an American woman who decided to do this kind of experiential film because of, I love Lang and what he was saying. He also went to the person's psychosis to engage with them rather than try to get them, pull them out and to be, this is what's normal, come here. He went, I get it, I see who you are. And then he eased people back into being who they were, though. He really felt that it was a shamanic journey to have a psychotic breakdown. Mm-hmm. And that really, it was a cathartic experience. So it was so much more accepting of people going there to discover who they are.
How like old were you?
My films to discover who I was.
How old were you when you read that book?
I must have been in my early 20s because I made my features in my 20s.
And how revelationary was it for you?
Well, completely, because the first line of my first movie was, dreams are more real than reality. In the day, it's quiet. So I kind of based the life of the character on enjoying her psychosis. And I have to say, he wrote The Divided Self too, which was a great book. And I was in the movie. So I'm the director, writer, and producer, and I'm in the movie. And when we went to edit and I saw myself on the screen, I'm talking about her all the time. Oh, she should have done it this way and I was directing myself part of the time. And so I was like living a schizophrenic life really well.
Really well, yeah. Yeah. Your second book, interesting one, Journeys Out of the Body by Robert Monroe, published in 1971. And after reading that, you actually went to the Monroe Institute, didn't you?
For over and over and over again. First of all, I was not, you know, the 60s was using drugs and getting there that way. I was a little trepidatious about drugs. I was kind of afraid of drugs. So using hemisync, going to other states of consciousness. Well, wait a minute. I was interested in this when I left college. I joined the American Society for Psychical Research with Carlos Osis and did all those tests, you know, where they hooked you up and put you into different, you went into different states. And I did those exercises where what's in an envelope. And I was kind of good at all that. So it really I always felt we had other capacities. I mean, we just had more and more. I met with Chuck Honerton and we discussed doing a documentary together because I was a filmmaker. But I realized in those days, this is, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, people are going to, what am I going to do with telepathy? I mean, I have a phone, you know, and it kind of didn't suit lifestyle at that time. But I was already ready for Maimonides Dream Lab, all that stuff. I wanted to share with Russell Targ and what they were doing at SRI, all those things on film. Eventually we didn't make it, but so going to Bob, to Monroe, which is this beautiful place, you know, in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and so fun. I mean, you get in a bed all day.
And leave your body there.
Yes and no, it's interesting. Well, anyway, and of course I was a dear friends with Karen Malik, who's an extraordinary, not only trainer, but person who helped develop the Monroe Institute. And so I found that I was having, I actually didn't have it. We would come into a group after you do these exercises and people tell all these stories and I'd be sitting there going, I was just like comfortable in the black void. What is that? And of course, that was kind of a good state to be in. But I did went to the professional. They invited me to the professional summer program, and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was there, which was a great joy. She's such a character. And I had gone into the state in when we were searching for other experiences, where I got really cold and started to spin with the souls of Biafran babies. And I mean, the stories were wonderful when you get a story. And I came out of that expressing, at first I had like chills in myself. And I told the group, you come back to the group and talk. And she used to call me the Biafran baby lady. So what happened to that story was they were souls that just came in for the pinch and then left again. And I was this transporter. I mean, that's a weird story, but I enjoyed that story. Years later, I ended up having a birthday party for a young man who happened to be African-American at my home. And I had 150 African-American young people bumping up to my house in Brentwood. I had to tell my neighbor that it was the birthday of the ambassador of Haiti's son, not to be nervous, because they were wondering who are all these people. And they all were in the pool and I was feeding them and there was some ganja going on. I had to ask them not to do that. And when they left, I went, those were my babies. It was a celebration. And it was just this combination of a story from another realm that became a story in this realm. And it integrated in some way into a touching story. So that was kind of, I hope everybody followed that. That was kind of, I tried to do it as quickly as possible.
And you got to meet Robert Monroe.
Oh yes, oh no, he was, what a delight. Yeah, well, thanks to Karen, because she was close to him. And we were discussing doing a book called How to Hear Hidden Voices together at some point. And yeah.
Fascinating. Book number three, Freedom from the Known by Krishnamurti, 1969.
Yeah, I remember sitting down over a year period and reading everything Krishnamurti wrote. I must have just found him good company. I can't remember much of what he was writing about, except I do know that Freedom from the Known is, if you read that, you'll know pretty much what he was imparting. And he was somebody who said, I don't want to be your guru, which of course, those are my favorite people. You know, when and he was teaching in the moment, you know, he was teaching to who he was speaking to. I think a great teacher is someone who doesn't tell you what they know, but tell you what you can hear. Mm. And so, yeah. I think I read Seth as well at the same time. I kind of like spread out everybody. So I was in one realm learning and I was in the philosophical, you know, more here realm with him. So I was reading the two at the same time. But I appreciated, you know, his what he was departing. And I think it's really important that he combines science with spiritual. And of course, people know to watch the David Bohm and Krishnamurti conversations.
So, did you ever meet him?
No, no. So, I didn't meet him. I never had it. I was never really interested in going to places everybody else was going. Like, I didn't even listen to the Beatles. I was like,
there's a confession.
No, I mean, I listened to them, but I mean, I never thought, oh, I've got to go to a Beatle concert. Of course, I ended up with a more unusual musician. I was friends with Frank Zappa. And so I did, his music was very architectural, very musically technical and challenging. But the popular stuff, I didn't. So, you know, you won't get me to a Tony Robbins or a Krishnamurti.
So why did you choose this particular book if you read all of his? What was it about this one?
Because I think it contains everything he had to say.
Right.
It's small, it's accessible, and freedom from the known. It's kind of a perfect pinpoint of pretty much. And then if you want to enjoy his commentaries and, you know, following through, that's fine. But I think that's a good pillar of what he had to say.
Mm. Yeah. Next book, number 4, was by your favorite beloved master teacher, Tao or Tao, The Pathless Path by Osho, published in 1978. What a bit of a divisive figure, controversial figure.
I get him. I'm sorry. I've only met one person who was with him, and I never again knew about him or saw him when he was alive. But I started walking. Someone gave me his tapes in those days, folks. And after they passed away, I got this gift of these tapes, and I started walking with him every day. And he's such good company. Because one, he doesn't take himself seriously. Two, he's irreverent. Three, I think he was challenging our worst to become our best by getting through it. And what that means is I think he evolved the sexual revolution-y stuff. He said, look, do it all. Get it out of your system. You know, see what it's worth to you. Then you can get to the quieter spaces in the meditation. And the Rolls Royce stuff, I totally got. He came to America, he said, I got more than you got, now what are you gonna do? That's not who you are. Mm-hmm. And I had mentioned that to someone who had been very close to him. He said, boy, you did get him. And I read a biography. I know he was whiffing something, or but he was in pain. He was, vilified. But I think people who create, well, he was, you know, exposing a lot of political stuff in both countries, in India and here and around the world. But I love his voice. And my God, you can go to Sufi, to Zen, to Buddhism, to Christianity, and he's spoken about it with such humanity. You know, the mustard seed on Christ is just a wonderful story of a real being. And that's the other thing was important. He says, I'm not here to be your teacher. I'm just here to be a being and be that example. And it was his presence. I just thoroughly enjoy him. And when he starts telling a joke, I mean, how can you... Let's meditate, and then I'm going to crack you up. You know, that's not taking yourself seriously.
Yeah. Well, my friend Chaitanya Parkin, who has been a guest on this show, spent a period of years with Osho as his joke writer.
Yeah,
that must have been a good job.
Yes, was he in San Diego? Because I tried to reach him once. Yeah. You mentioned him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, book number 5, The River, by Jaya Sati Bhagavati, 1994. I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly or not, but I know that you loved Ma and you've spent the past 32 years as part of her teaching and community. So tell us about this book, how it came into your life, how you found her.
I was running AIDS, I can't remember the, children, hold on, quick. Center for Living for people with AIDS. And she came to speak. And she was just delightful. I mean, she was a reverend, my favorite, and all there. And she said something about, I'm writing 7 books. And I thought, no, you can't be doing that. I didn't know who I was talking to. So I went up to her. I said, you know, I coach writers. I'd love to talk with you and see. So I went down to the ashram and met with her. And oh my God, this, I could imitate her. This woman was a Jew from Brooklyn who loved Christ and became an incarnation in some sense of Kali and just stripped people. But she loved Hanuman, who was the monkey god of service. And her whole teaching was to serve the gay community, the AIDS community, the street community, the elderly, just, you know, I don't know. I fell in love with the ashram's the most beautiful place in the world. I don't know how, because it's not a bunch of rich people. It's people who just keep it going. And it's so beautiful there, and it's interfaith. And I started going, and I started traveling with her. And I also did her teaching videos. And we would talk. I had no idea the power of this person I was dealing with. I was so kind of the innocent one. But she was very, very kind with me and brought me in. And I did, as I said, her teaching videos and asked her questions. And she took me to hospices and hospitals, and we would feed people. And she'd get to a hospital and she'd go on the mic and she'd go, "Ma's here! I got cookies!" And I go, "Oh my God, that voice." That's, I said, "Why do you use that voice?" That was her voice, but she could also do peaceful meditation. She said it wakes the sound in people who are in comas. It awakens them internally. She also wore perfume that was very strong so that people who were not well could know she was there. I mean, everything she did, she had a purpose. She was wearing pantsuits when we first started the videos. And I said, "You should be wearing a sari. You're on the Parliament of World Religions. You've taken the AIDS quilt to Africa. You're a spiritual teacher." And she looked at me, she says, "I can't do it until you ask me." That's when I got, we were the ones that got her to teach what she taught, not her telling us what she knew. Again, that kind of teaching where they were paying attention to who they were talking to, not just spewing information. Anyway, I took my children there over the years, and and every month we made sandwiches in LA and took them into the streets. So she got me to learn to love the streets and feeding people. And it was wonderful for me. I hope it was useful to them, but I loved making food for people in the streets and did it for years after. I just did it on my own and when I was in the band.
What was so special about this particular book?
Well, it has her voice in the depths of the flow of being the mother. And where she, I mean, she could, I have to just tell you this one story. I went to the first kind of, we did all the Hindu rituals for the ma and stuff. And the first one was they washed her feet and we were supposed to come up and bow. And, you know, so she was kind of in this trancy thing. And I was the first time I came up and one of her chelas said, sannyasin said, Trishulama, which was, she gave me a Hindu name. You don't have to kiss her feet, just pranam. And she goes,
she doesn't know what the fuck she's doing. Leave her alone.
It was so joyous, you know. So I love the community, the people there, all, and as I said, everything, traveling with her, and I don't know how I got there, but I stayed.
What do you think you learned from her? What was the most important thing you learned?
Well, you know, she gave me a family. I ended up from a family hospice. I ended up having African-American children. Five of them ended up in my life forever. Now I have 15 grandchildren and all of them still in my life, which I love. She just was someone who, yes, the meditation was there, but the service to just be in the streets, to be there for people, you know, who needed to have us be a part of their lives. Of course, they gave us more than we gave them, just to be, hang with them, you know, and be a part of their lives. So I think that's, and her character and her joyousness and her madness and her reverence and her strength. And she was a woman, you know, in the world of religious teachers. So she was on the outskirts of it and couldn't be as, you know, those other gurus who everybody followed. And she made good friends with the Sikh Bhagwan. And we used to go visit him and the Sikhs, and just, everybody was welcome. That was the thing. And everybody, no one was thrown away. Everybody was worthy.
Yes, indeed they are. Yeah. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be back in a few minutes, so stay tuned.
Om Times TV.
Maya Angelou once said that there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and when I'm not hosting Om Times Media's flagship radio show, What Is Going On, and the No BS Spiritual Book Club, I help people share their untold stories. Books are my life, my joy, and my passion, and there is no greater reward than helping aspiring writers get their books out of their heads and into the hands of those who are waiting to read them. If you feel that you have a book in you but don't know where to begin, visit sedgbeer.com, click on the Work With Me tab, and find out how my experience helping others tell their stories might be just what you've been looking for. That's sedgbeer.com, sedgbeer.com.
Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust, spheric approach. Om Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Om Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Om Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on Om Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive Om Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. Om Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Karen Sperling, book number 6, Matrix Energetics, The Science and Art of Transformation by Richard Bartlett, played a pivotal role in your life for several reasons. Tell us about them.
Well, just real quick, by the way, Kashi Ashram is still functioning, and you can go to kashi.org, and her grandson does a Chosen retreat there that's beautiful. So there's still opportunities to be a part of that incredible community. Okay, matrix energetics. So I always was interested in altered states of consciousness, and I always felt we had capacities that we were not using. And over 50 years, I studied with different bioenergy teachers and did studies, and I did, anyway, so one day somebody recommended this matrix energetics, and I went in LA to with Richard Bartlett, and I had so much fun. And for whatever happened, I started going to every single seminar, which was about every other weekend. And over about a 7-year period, I ended up on the staff and teaching, helping teach. And it brought together the physics and the playfulness of getting into the field. It was interesting. It's you so dissolved. If you kind of felt that field and expanded, you literally would melt. And I was one of the expert melters and entertainers because I would just step in that field and go. But it was just. He taught and changed things all the time. So I wasn't just doing the same. We weren't sitting doing the same thing over and over. There were tools. We used parallel universes and frequencies and dolphins and, but again, this kind of magical play. And every time it was different. So, when you learn a consciousness tool-based whatever, they go, you do this, this, and this to get this, this, and this result. Like the medical profession, but in matrix energetics, you just kind of stepped into it. You noticed what showed up. You saw where your attention was drawn. You don't go in the problem set. You don't go, okay, what's the problem? I usually say, what would you like to attend to? So that keeps it kind of open. You ask open-ended questions. If you don't go into the pillar, what's the best thing that could happen here? Like I want it to be good. It's more like, what would it look like if it was different? So there was this wonderful kind of openness to allow information to come in and then to trust that information. And the weirder, the better. And I found, again, I've never done the same thing twice in a seminar or when I practice. I don't practice with a hinge on a in an office. I just do it wherever I am, literally in the market and on a hike with somebody in my house, or just go, fresh meat. Would you like to notice what it feels like to be in a more at ease state? And is there something you'd like to attend to? And it's the bottom line is after practicing being that field for all those years, I kind of have it carrying in me. So the minute I go to somebody, they have it too. And they start to feel this kind of wave. We kind of get into the oscillating field. And Richard was just delight to be with. And as I said, he kept bringing in more and more and newer and newer information. So it never got boring. And we taught anywhere from 125 to 600 people. And it was it's become part of my life. I mean, I love to blend when I'm with someone. I know they notice a shift. There's a kind of wonderful resonance that comes up. Whatever story shows up, which is a pattern of information that helps you shift something. I said the weirdest things to people and they go, oh yeah, I get that. Because I didn't think of it. It just came in. I can tell a story. The other day, one of the most recent ones, I was with a woman and she has difficulties with a son who's doing things that are addictive and not and destructive to the family. So she, so we started to just notice the state, and I started to talk to her about how she communicates with her son and that how close they are. And she agreed with some of the things I suggested about listening to him instead of fixing it right away. Just, you know, practical stuff. I'm not a therapist, but practical stuff from Rosa. And we were kind of done, and I started to leave. And she said, wait a minute, my son just texted me. He never texts me. And she opened it and said, I love you. So that was that wonderful expansive connection that comes up. One time I was with a friend who has cancer, and she was supposed to have chemo, and she was lying in her bed, and I went, kick, 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 kick. No chemo. Kick, 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 kick. No chemo. Sometimes weird stuff. I just do stuff that comes in like energetically. And she went, oh, Karen, you're so crazy. Okay. So 3 days later, she calls me and she says, I forgot my chemo appointment. I called my doctor and he said, you don't need chemo. I rechecked it. Okay. So those are the kind of things that over the years of thousands of people now that I've been able to interact with, just wonderful things come up. And it was because I learned from Matrix Energetics. And the book is good. I reread it.
Well, I was going to say, tell us what people will find in the book.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure they're not going to walk away doing everything that you do after.
No, you're going to do it the way you do it. A couple of keys. You're not in the problem set. You don't care what the outcome is. Because once you get into that, I'm fixing somebody, or I'm healing somebody, or I'm doing something, you're in something that you want to have a more expansive availability to what's possible. That's what it teaches, is to go into what's possible.
Okay, so what's in the book that people would benefit
from? He outlines he'll talk about how he got there, and also what the kind of philosophy is of using the quantum field, the zero point field, and how to step into that. And then he talks about the two point process, where you find a point that you notice, and another point that draws your attention, and you collapse the wave so that you kind of bring those two things together. It's a good basic Matrix Energetics, full on what it's about.
Did you read the book first and then go to the seminars, or were you already attending them?
He hadn't written the book yet. No. I just went and just once I was collapsing on the floor, giggling, I said, this is for me.
This is for you. Right. Okay. So moving on to book 7, this is Arrow to the Sun by Caldecott honoree, author and illustrator Gerald McDermott, who was an illustrator for you on your children's books. This was published in 1974, and I know you like all of his books, but I wouldn't let you include them all. So this is the one you picked.
Yeah, because this book went into the schools and was the first book that expressed what Native American life and stories were about. So he actually put Native American tales and stories and their lives into the schools. And he was honored by many tribes for that. I went with him once to a sun ceremony, which was, you know, with the Kachina dolls in a tribal a reservation. Because he was so honored, they allowed him to come to it, and they allowed him to. It was amazing with the Kachina dance and everything, the sun dance. Anyway, but I think this is an importantly valuable book to have the first time someone shared a Native American tale that became something all the teachers taught in schools. Mm. Okay.
Book number 8. I think this is the one that comes next, Cast. The origins.
So,
at the weekends.
Okay, so we'll talk about how he contributed to my books later.
Yes, we will. Yeah. We'll come back to that.
Yeah. Cast, okay, I feel every American should read Cast, black, white, whatever. First of all, she's deep and palatable. Somehow her stream of how she writes makes it so, you know, you can just munch on it. And it's incredibly important information about who we are as Americans. And I'm reading her.
We should say who she is. It's the Pulitzer Prize-winning best-selling author Isabel Wilkerson.
Yeah. I'm reading her other book too now, and it's again just empowering. It was very important to me, and I actually have biracial children, grandchildren, and African American grandchildren, and I wish they would read the book because they will see what their a genetic, emotional genetic story is, and what's happening to them because of a whole history. And it gave me, I have a lot of my daughters, or who I call my daughters, have had children with men who haven't been able to take care of their children. Never made me angry, but it certainly felt like I wish they had been able to be more fathers to their children. But reading this book gave me a lot of insight into where they're coming from and what is deeply embedded in them and where they can't get the opportunities and they can't get the support. And it gave me a lot of helpful insight deeply into their story.
Yeah, I think few people really understand, I certainly didn't, we obviously have many races in England, but I remember reading Yenla Van Zandt's story and my jaw was on the floor because I had no idea how, the lineage, everything, the things that are multi-generational patterns that are passed down. We need to have our eyes open.
No, and I do see my children profiled. I've had several real experiences with them getting beaten up or arrested or kicked out of school because of that bend towards profiling. Yeah. My only experience as a Jew was when I went to college the first year in Orange County in the 60s, my roommate came in and looked at me and she went, "You don't have horns." I said, "Excuse me?" She came from a family that said, "You're going to have a Jewish roommate? She's going to have horns."
yeah, the stereotyping.
Yeah.
Okay. Book number 9. This is a book that has come up quite a few times in the book club. People seem to love it. Always women, I think. Initiation by Elizabeth H. 1953, which was an autobiography. Tell us about it.
Well, I read it a long time ago, but I recommend it all the time. here's somebody who showed you how you could learn from another dimension or another lifetime or another identity. And that's thrilling. And I think if you could pay attention to some of that and hear that voice in you that might come from other information, she laid it all out so wonderfully and got so much out of it. So it's a really shining example of that. I studied doing past life regressions with Betty Binder years ago, And when I would do it, when she would do it with me, I found them the most moving, touching, therapeutic experiences. And I went to progressed lives as well, not just past. And I also reviewed the book by Rogers on Other Lives, Other Selves, using hypnosis to find when in your life from another life. I don't believe in anything. I don't believe in past lives. I don't believe in karma. I don't believe in auras. I don't believe in anything until it shows up. And so what? So I'm not looking for it. So when I do my work too, and I've had many times, sometimes another lifetime, when I'm with someone, show up, and it's the story that resonates with them. That's how they became something. And so, you know, also Judy Wilkerson Smith, who has this emotional coding book, you know, has that, and our DNA books and our consciousness of connection to all information. All of this is all available to us. So this book, you know, was somebody who literally got a whole feed of information that she shared in very, very clear ways. And so it's a wonderful story and how useful that can be, that information.
Well, the final book on your list is one that, again, comes up time and time again, and it's usually women who add it to their lists. It certainly is one of my favourites. It's The Mists of Avalon by Marion Zimmer Bradley, and that was published in 1982.
Yeah. Boy, I wish we were had a couple of islands to go to and do some of that stuff. We need our tribals to get back together and look. Here it is again, transforming history. I mean, history had women in it. I mean, Mary Magdalene is still struggling to be the powerhouse she was and the partnership she was in. There are wonderful books about her influence. And so this was, you know, fiction, but so wonderfully displaying this secret behind the throne, you know, the power behind. And I think I mentioned in what I wrote was I collect witches because one, I love their costumes, but I also know that they're healers. You know, I was saying my grandchildren go, why do you have all these scary witches around? And go, because they're healers, they're not scary. So it's the book transforms this understanding of empowerment by women in history that I'm sure we could dig up a whole bunch more.
Yeah.
And write more good books about it.
And it's also a wonderful reminder of our connection to nature.
Yeah.
You know, and everything that we've lost.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's your 10 best list. Now let's talk about you. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, your grandfather, your family, you know, pretty much considered the closest thing to royalty that Hollywood has. Tell us who your grandfather was and tell us what it was like growing up in a family that were that well known.
Well, my grandfather was the CEO and created Warner Brothers. His name was Harry Warner, H.M. Warner. So he was the oldest brother. And there were four brothers. The brother who wanted to put sound on film, Sam, they had interesting tragedies in the family. He passed away 2 days before sound was the Jolson story opened. And then the next oldest brother was Albert, and he kind of hung out at the racetrack. Then Jack, whom a lot of people know, Jack Warner, because he was kind of the upfront producer man and the most despicable character. He was like, was just a, he just was, you know, he gambled and he women and he was, but anyway, but so my grandfather, of course, was conservative and caring, and his motto was to entertain and educate. Anyway, so eventually Jack stole the studio from him just before he passed away after having a stroke. So there's a wonderful whole family story behind all that. But that was my grandfather. He created the Dream Factory.
Now, how do you think growing up in that family benefited you, and how did it hold you back, or perhaps didn't benefit you?
My mom didn't want us to identify with being, I don't know how, because my father made 50 feature films, and he was he had United States Pictures, and he was a producer and writer, and we had writers in the house, and we had movie stars over, and we had directors, and we had the first CinemaScope screen in our living room, you know, where we could show movies, and I'd lie on the floor and watch movies. But she didn't really want us to be identified with it. It was interesting. But you know, I mean, we ended up living in a big house, bigger than most, and as I said, we had people coming and going, and but my dad was a classical pianist, and he respected musicians quite a bit, and we used to have Lee Stravinsky at the house, and Heifetz, and Pietagorsky, you know, so there was kind of an intellectual level to stardom, and there was kind of the other level of like actors, and I got to grow up when I could go on to the studio. I worked at the studio when I was 16, got stopped by Warren Beatty and asked if I was interested, and told him I was Milton Sperling's daughter, and he drove off quite quickly. I watched Natalie Wood throw a glass of whiskey in Bob Wagner's face because they had a fight in our living room. And when Gary Cooper died, I ran down the stairs and said, "Dad, Gary Cooper died." And he started crying. You know, I had a long range of, I would go to the set. I got to watch a movie Dad was making with Susan Hayward and Kirk Douglas. So sometimes I could go and, you know, see what he was. I was named, he did Sonya Henie movies, and one of her characters was Karen in the Sun Valley Serenade, which is shown every day in Sun Valley. People came to play tennis who were, oh, Anthony Quinn. He and I became blood brother and blood sister at one point because we pricked our fingers. He asked if it, so those are pretty rarefied experiences for most people. And you know, I get that. And for a long time, because as I said, my mom didn't want us to think we're special because we're that, it kind of went under the radar. And even when I made my films, my family were not very supportive. They wondered what the heck was I doing. And my dad, he came when I was shooting my second film with this all-woman crew and took me to dinner. He says, "What do you think you're doing? Who are your mentors?" I said, "Dad, there are none. There's only a couple of, there's Maya Duren in France. Nobody, there are no women making film." So he says, "I don't know what you think you're doing." So he came to the set the next day and he watched me direct. I had 200 people on the set that day. And he, at the end of the day, he said, "Gee, you know what you're doing." So that helped. But then my mom stopped speaking to me after I made my first film. I think she felt I was exposing myself too much. And you know what? I watched the film. She was right. Recently, 50 years ago, to do what I did psychologically to this character and physically and everything was pretty suspenseful and scary. And I think she felt I was overexposed. Anyway, and she was an artist. So it's kind of mixed bag. I did not get help. I wrote a book my father bought the option for and wouldn't let me write the teleplay for it when he was going to do it for television. It's most people think, oh, she's a Warner. When I went to the Carnegie Hall Theater to see my film with an audience, I went to the ladies' room to hear what they were thinking. I said, "Why didn't she make a Western? Isn't she a Warner?" But anyway, you would think that I would get kind of gently put into the whole industry and go, look at her. It was too soon. This was the early 70s. There were no women in the industry, which is why I hired women. Mm. It was just too soon to understand what I was doing or why.
Yeah. You, I mean, the whole family, you know, creativity, as I said, runs in the blood. I mean, you've got a famous nephew. We didn't mention the names of some of the relatives, but, you know, feel free to tell us.
Oh, well, so my cousin was Warner Leroy, and he had Warner Safari, and he did, I have to remember, the Tavern on the Green. He was a restaurateur and a kind of entrepreneur. He was a delightful character.
And the Wizard of Oz?
And his father, Mervyn Leroy, did the Wizard of Oz.
Right.
And Mort Janklow was a big literary agent. And again, when I did my children's books, I just couldn't get help from him. I got to create everything I believed in, but everything I believed in and created seemed to have been so out of the box and new or different that I don't know, people say you're too early or too, you know, it's not your time or whatever, but at least I got to do it and believe in it and enjoy it and give it to the community. And we'll see, maybe when I'm on a walker, somebody will say, oh my God, I saw your film or I read your book.
Well, you must tell us who your nephew, who's currently in a very highly rated TV show.
Yeah, my sister raised a very loving, wonderful guy who worked really hard, and he's now Rip on Yellowstone, which I live near Fresno. Everybody is extremely excited about, and of course, everybody around the country I know, because he's a wonderful character. He does a great job, and she did a great job raising him. Yeah, as a good guy.
You wrote an original musical about the life and times of a spiritualist who ran for president of the United States and fought for equal rights at the turn of the century. Who was that?
That was Victoria Woodhull, and her sister, Tennessee Claflin, was right behind her. I originally wrote it as a screenplay. I thought Jane Fonda and Goldie Hawn would be perfect for it. And then I wrote it as a miniseries because it was like an upstairs, downstairs, because they were involved in all of our history at that time. Tammany Hall, the Hatton Brigade, the biggest scandal with Reverend Beecher, who was sleeping with his best friend wife. And, you know, anyway, so she was just a great combination of our history and women. And then I wrote it as a Broadway musical called Voices. I tried every avenue of getting her story out there. Yeah.
Well, that was certainly out of the box. I mean, she was out of the box, running for president at the turn of the century.
A free love candidate, she was called.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Interesting. Tell us about Invitational Books, because this is a series of books that is very innovative and... probably, as you said, something that, you know, maybe ahead of its time, I don't know, but it's something that is a really interesting way of encouraging children to use their imagination.
Well, I had children, a big library of books, and nobody touched them. So at some point, I remember I was sitting, I was writing after I took everybody to school and cleaned up the house. And I was sitting there, and my dad used to say, tell a story. So I went, once upon a time, and ba-da-loom, with like in 3 months, 24 stories came out, Tales of Enchantment. And I thought, okay, I have these stories, but so what? They're going to sit on a shelf just like my kids' books do. How about I make them interactive where they can help me make the book? So I found Gerald McDermott, and I decided to have them read the story, create the character, complete the pictures, and write their own story in the book. And so there's the stories are literature. It's not Choo Choo Train. It's transformational. The character becomes who they want to be. And I had Gerald as kind of a director. I had him do these soft lines. It's not a coloring book. It's just these soft lines of the moment of the story on the page, which we call invitational books, art. And then they can kind of, and little prompts, and they can kind of, they end up illustrating the book and creating their own character. Are we breaking any rules here? Coloring in a book, creating the character, you know, you can't have Goofy doing this or Donald Duck. This is your character, which is, brings, I'm kind of a Rudolf Steiner lover of education, and this brings the child into becoming what they're learning. So by the end of the story, they can write their own story then about what they would do as a character, and they put their name in. So it's, they make the book with us, and it was my 30 years ago idea, and I ended up with a business partner, and we almost had a deal with Crayola, we almost had a deal with McGraw-Hill, we almost had a deal with a few places, but for some reason there's 12 completed books, 4 I ended up printing myself, 20,000 books, and over the years during the pandemic, I gave 10,000 books to kids in shelters and hospitals and schools at that time. But so that's kind of the overall.
And when the kids get their hands on them, you know, the feedback is incredible.
The teachers, the schools, the after school programs. I did them with the Boys and Girls Clubs, shelters, parents. They all love it. I don't know what happened to the publishers, except that it's a big project.
Publishers, they don't want to take a chance. They really don't. They want, you know, a sure deal.
Well, at this time, kids more than anything need to be touching something, creating something, showing it to people, seeing who the head of the Boys and Girls Club said, this will show us who our kids are as individuals. Then you can do it at different ages because you can see their development. Yeah. So marketing wise, you have to buy, you don't just buy one Goodnight Moon and pass it down for 30 years. You have to buy one little dreamer from one to the next, because each person has to play in it. So each child. So if you have 4 kids, and then you have to buy 4 books.
Well, I love the idea of kids becoming co-creators of their own books and their own stories. I mean, of course I would, you know, books are, you know, everything that I do. And I really do think that our children, you know, kids love to be creative. They're never going to stop being creative. You know, they're using their imagination all the time. And hey, we had this whole, you know, popular coloring book thing phase that went on for, you know, a few years ago, and I think these would do just as well with the kids.
Well, I'm not giving up. Thanks to you, you've always encouraged me and helped me build this, which I have no idea how to do, you and your son, my website, invitationalbooks.com. I wouldn't have that without you.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the other bits. You know, you've done an awful lot of work with the homeless, and you're part of a street jam band playing on the boardwalk in Venice, and you're a mother to many and a grandmother of many, and as you said, you know, a member of an interfaith community that serves the homeless and families with AIDS. That's something that's very out of the box for someone who grew up in the kind of family that you did. I'm not saying that wealthy, famous people don't have souls, you know, or, you know, incredible empathy for those that aren't as well off for themselves. But you actually got out there, down and dirty, and you were walking on the streets and you were helping people.
Well, my family, my mom and dad and my stepfather, were political activists in the way that they were in those days, which was to educate people. They had people in their home 3 times a week at least, anywhere from 30 to 200 people, educating them on what was going on in the world and what was needed to be supported. They were fundraisers. And, you know, there were the dinners with the chicken and the steak and the salmon. And that's where I rebelled. So I go, I'd rather be hands-on. I don't know. I just felt more comfortable being than getting dressed to go to a dinner and raise money. But that was brilliant what they did. And they did it for 50 years. So I just wanted to be in the trenches and hands-on. Of course, Ma got me moving into that. And it just, I don't know, I love making food for people. I was a cookie ma. I was cookie ma for about 3 years. I would go down every week with 300 cookies. And we did the lunches and the things. And I, because I had these children in my life who, you know, slept on the couches and I fed breakfast and were in my home all the time. I think when I was down with people in the streets, they could smell it, that I was comfortable with that. And I still got to go back to a comfortable home. No, there's no doubt about it. I did not experience their lives. Yeah. And I ended up going down with a friend who ended up living with a friend of mine who was living in a van, playing drums with them. And I said, well, I'm going to go. So every weekend I would go down. I started on the drums. We had a small drum orchestra with this wonderful man, Abraham, who made sure people got food, got clothes. He lived in a van. He was an artist on the streets, and we were, you know, friends for 25 years. And I just started playing. Then I realized that it hurt my hands because I'm a little older. And so I had bought a flute after my daughter passed away. She had been a musician, and I didn't want the music to die with her. So I got this a Native American flute, but I couldn't play it because I'd start crying for 15 years. So I didn't cry for 15 years, and I picked it up again, and I got a street cube and a mic, and I just started playing with the drums. And over the years, I taught myself with backing tracks on YouTube. But every weekend, I just loved going down there. I loved it when there were long weekends. And just setting up 11 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock in the evening, it's the purest form of music, to play music to people passing by. They're at the same level you are. They come, they go, they dance, they listen, they leave. And you just keep jamming and speaking to each other as musicians. It's just, to me, it's the best way to play music.
Mm. I have a couple of questions for you that might seem unrelated to books, but this is by way of some research I'm doing for a new project. Considering what is happening in our world right now on so many different levels, what would it take, do you think, for you to secure the future of your children and grandchildren? What is required?
I don't know if there are answers in the world, but there are ways to participate in your community. The only thing I can recommend at this point, because it's not even a conversation anymore, how do we save the planet? How do we stop wars? I mean, I'm on a council for saving the forests. I'm on in a communication group with people on a nuclear wake-up call and you know, getting women into the conversation of nuclear proliferation. Okay, but I basically feel that within your family, how you communicate, how you care for each other, within your community, how you serve, how you step into each day, doing something for someone else or being there for someone else, listening, you know, that's it, and encouraging. I had one of my grandchildren went on kind of a rant with me and really hit home the sore points. and I congratulated her. I said, boy, you're smart enough to know exactly where to go to get me. That's pretty good. Now I need to know why you got triggered to do that. But instead of yelling back at her, how dare you say that to me? You know, it's so listening in a calm way and communicating with each other. We have to start in the community. We have to start in our homes. Yeah. Because whoever's running this world poorly, it's my family, as I said, we're politically active for the last 70 years. And I kept saying, it's got to come from within. It's got to come from our consciousness. Gathering in groups. I have several tribes that I gather with, small, medium, large, where we hold the possibilities and hold the state of it moving through. And then you got to do something. You can't just say, oh, I know that's happening. You know, that's awful. So how do you contribute individually as best you can, when you can? And notice, I mean, I keep reporting there's water overflows in our community that I just heard. It's getting me because we need to just conserve water. Whatever you see and notice and help change as best you can.
Yeah. One final question. What are you reading now?
Well, I'm reading Isabel Wilkerson's book, Other Sun, The Warmth of Other Suns. I have a stack. I have to read. I kind of have to flip around. So, and I have to confess, by the time I get down, there's one or two TV programs that I just have to sit in front of and go, this is so fun. I love these characters. I'm watching The Closer right now with Sedgwick. It's fabulous. But I'm sorry, I have a whole stack that's next.
Okay.
Also, wait, I'm in a reading group twice a week. Wonderful friends who are a wonderful eclectic group of intellectual and spiritual and fun people. And we're reading the meaning of the soul, Rilke's biography, and her Heraclitus, or, you know, all something that I would never read except for this group. But it always comes out to a conversation that has real depth and meaning personally. But we read Jung's The Red Book through. I mean, nothing I would have chosen to sit down by myself, but I get so much out of this group being together as one of my tribes twice a week. So comes and goes, a poet. And
I think that's our bell telling us we're almost out of time.
That's the one I said, don't keep texting me.
Yeah. So she keeps texting you.
But it's her, it's the group, Carl McCluskey's, the McCluskey group that I met.
Okay. Oh, Karen Sperling. Thank you for adding your 10 best list to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's Library of Recommendations. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for asking me. I, of course, love you dearly, and you're the best.
Thank you. So if you would like to know more about Karen Sperling's immersive children's book series, visit invitationalbooks.com. And if you've stayed the course throughout this episode, you've already heard a little bit about what I do. So I'm not going to tell you again. But if you've enjoyed this show, you can watch many, many more episodes, all the way back to the beginning. There's over 100 of them now on the No BS Spiritual Book Club's website. You can also sign up for our Save My Space list and receive last minute reminders of future episodes. That's it for this week. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. I'll be back at the same time next week with another 10 best interview for the No BS Spiritual Book Club. Till then, it's goodbye from me. Thank you, Karen.
Bye, thank you.